Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. 1 year ago, a sweeping, in-depth report on reforming the Metropolitan Police Department was submitted to the D.C. Council. More than three dozen people from a cross-section of the community helped author the report and its many, many recommendations. So what has happened during the past year? What is the status of D.C. police reform? Well, joining me to talk about this are Nike Svevain, policy counsel with the D.C. Justice Lab, and Ron Hampton, convener with the D.C. Justice Collaborative and retired D.C. police officer. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at H Fisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Nike and Ron, thank you both for joining the conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher, for having us.
Thank you. So neither one of you are outsiders to this process. Both of you were intimately involved. You were part of this reform commission. And it's been a year, and yet I would argue both of you are not quite happy with where the reform process is 1 year later. Nike, kind of summarize your concerns about where we are right now.
Sure, thank you.
Sure.
So I think my primary concern is that it feels like we're going backward, right? So last year, the primary recommendation of our report and sort of the central theme of our report was that safety is about so much more than the absence of harm and policing specifically. We continue to center policing in our conception of public safety, and we think that's the wrong approach because policing and the criminal legal system dominate the conversation around safety. But when you actually ask people what makes them feel safe, you hopefully wouldn't be surprised to find out that police are not at the center of that. It's really about building community and support and meeting people's basic needs, which is why even though we were asked to look at policing specifically, we ended up making a lot of recommendations around meeting people's basic needs. Last night, I actually did a presentation as part of my job to a group of local residents. And when I asked them what made them feel safe, they said things like people smiling, having their own bed, having familiar places, their mom, blankets, right? So these are things that provide people comfort. And it's not about sort of the policing infrastructure as the center of public safety. And so we're really trying to get an expanded conversation around public safety. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel like we're getting there yet.
A lot of recommendations in this report, Ron. Talk to me about some of the most important recommendations and where the police department is right now with them.
Well, let me answer the last part of it first, Harold. They're in the same place they were before it started because nothing has happened. But as far as recommendations, some of the things that we thought were important, and it leads into what Nike is talking about, is, for example, moving the police out of traffic stops because it's detrimental and it leaves a bitter taste in not just the individual who was stopped, but the community's mouth. Banning no-knock warrants, the serving of no-knock warrants, taking police officers out of schools. Also, the issue around having mental health workers respond to calls where individuals are having mental health challenges, those kind of basic things. And it goes to exactly what Nike is talking about because for years, police leaders have been talking about the police aren't going to arrest themselves out of it. We go to calls that don't have nothing to do with police work. Well, what happened during this 18 months that we were serving in this commission that we thoroughly examined and came up and concluded that those are the things that we need to do in order to, if you will, unload the police department from the things that they don't want to do, shouldn't have never, ever been involved in, but have all to do with public safety in our communities and in our cities. And they haven't moved on those kind of things. They just haven't moved on because, and a lot of those recommendations were recommendations that the police chief could do himself. Didn't have to be approved by the city council, didn't have to be approved by the mayor. But then there were recommendations that also had, that led into legislation, and they're sitting there. The one that I know that they did move on, that was supposed to be moving the police out of schools, I think by the 2024, 2025. But if the mayor has her way, then that won't happen, and we'll be hiring more police, which we suggested to do some analysis and research on what police officers do and the right number of police officers in terms of what the city needs. And it's something that we should be doing. We should be analyzing that situation.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the police reform report that was issued a year ago this month on reforming the D.C. Police Department. Where is it now? And what can be done to expedite some of the recommendations? If you have any comments or questions about this issue, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I had a chance to get a statement today from D.C. Councilmember Charles Allen. He is, of course, the chair of the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee on the D.C. Council. The statement is quite lengthy, indeed, quite a bit too much for me to read on the air. However, I would like to, you know, point out, you know, a few things. One of the things that he talks about is the massive undertaking of the revised Criminal Code Act. He said that's going to be addressed later this year. He talked a great deal about some of the issues that will have to be codified through the D.C. Council. And suffice it to say, some 259 pages of this report. Nike, do you believe that it may be too much to ask the battleship that is the D.C. government to hook a U-turn and implement these recommendations in a year?
So, no. The short answer is no. I don't think it's too much to ask. We were also really intentional about giving a roadmap of how to get these things done. It really is an ongoing effort. There, in no way did we expect everything to be done, implemented, funded within a year. We knew that that was unrealistic. But what we did expect to see and hope to see was a commitment to actually doing a deep dive and really interrogating why we continue to center police, like Ron said, in places that they shouldn't be centered, right? And with respect to
for example, give me an example of that, if you can, please.
Sure. So, as Ron mentioned, 911 calls for mental health emergencies go to police because they are the best funded, they're most resourced, they have the capacity to respond quickly to crises. And what we were saying in the report, what we recommended, was twofold. In the short term and the long term, investing in the community so that fewer people rise to the level of having that kind of emergency or that kind of crisis, and also creating an alternative response so that it's not police officers who show up who are not mental health professionals, right, and who show up with the threat of violence with them, whether they are being aggressive or not, because we know that they show up armed, they show up with a badge, and everybody knows what the potential consequences of those interactions are. So instead, we propose, you know, have social workers, people with mental health backgrounds show up and be supportive, which we've seen be really successful in other states. And so there is a pilot program, a small pilot program in the district right now.
Yeah, that's the community response team.
Their initial mm-hmm. funding for this pilot program actually only allowed them to serve maybe 2% of those kinds of calls. And the second phase is supposed to allow them to serve maybe a third. And what we're saying is, again, that's not enough. We'd like to see them fully funded sooner rather than later. Again, understanding that it might not happen, you know, tomorrow, but really wanting to see that sort of investment. And again, not just in that alternative response, but in meeting people's needs so that we don't get to the point of everybody being in crisis.
Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Police Reform Commission report 1 year later. Where is the D.C. Police Department when it comes to reform? Let's go to Lena, calling from D.C. Lena, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
So I just have a comment because I heard the young man that was on, and he was basically saying that they need to take about policing being out of the schools on a certain deadline. They need the police in the schools because we have a lot of crime and violence going on amongst the teenagers. That's where it's highly, you know, at. And it's on outside the school, within the school, you know, and we need to keep the police in there. That's the problem. We don't have enough policing, you know, for the teenagers, the youth. I mean, it's a lot of the violence is built up and the murdering and stuff amongst them. So we need the police in the schools. We don't need to take them out of the schools.
Lena, thank you so much. What about that, Ron?
The reason that they're in there has to do with the data. And the data does not substantiate police being in schools.
Explain that if you can.
The data meaning calls for incidents that happen in the schools. Whether or not officers can arrest students or do officers get involved in administrative actions in school? I have a little bit of experience in this myself because when I was on the police department, I worked in the schools as an officer friendly. And one of the things that I would always say is that if a student gets involved in a situation in the school, it's an administrative issue. I would not allow the principals that I worked with to drag me into an administrative issue. Police officers get involved in situations that are what? Criminal, not administrative. But that line is blurred sometimes. And the justification has to be if there are incidents in school, criminal incidents in school. I don't know where this parent have children in school, but there are schools that I go in today, it's like going into a prison that students have to line up, book bags, and all those kind of things. Those have a profound impact, psychological impact on students. Nobody wants to be going into that type of situation.
So hold on. Let me, if I may, Ron, because I remember the officer friendly program. I remember it very well. First of all, do you think it would work? And I would challenge you that the students during the officers that police had to deal with during the officer-friendly program back in the 1970s are not like, these students are built different, as they say. Okay, these are not, you know, let's call a spade a spade.
Okay. We can debate that, but let me tell you this. The officer-friendly program, officers were not stationed in the schools. They went from school to school doing program, educational program, and teaching street law and those kind of things. What the police department here and across the nation has today is actually where we have police officers stationed in schools.
Mm-hmm.
In schools. That's very different than the officer-friendly program. So there's no comparison there. But the students today in a fundamental way are no different. But there's no reason or justification for having police officers in school arresting students. We actually had school and evidence where principals would allow the police to come in and make an arrest of a student for some administrative problem that the student was having, say, not showing up at court.
Mm-hmm.
Then if he's coming to school, that is not the place to arrest him, because we need them to come to school. Now, if he didn't show up at court, that was one thing. But they could have chosen some other location to make the arrest. But you don't arrest the student and come in the classroom and arrest the student. And the principal shouldn't allow that to happen either.
Okay.
So there are situations.
Yeah.
Can I speak to this really
quickly?
Please
do. Please do.
Thank you. So, Ms. Lena, I completely understand your concern. And as part of our work on the commission, we absolutely listened to people with all different kinds of perspectives on this issue.
That's right.
And what we found was that most often it's actually the adults who are asking for police and not the students. If you look at the Police Free Schools movement, like the amazing work that Black Swan Academy is doing, for example, these are youth-led movements. It's the young people, the children, the students who are asking us to take police out of their schools. And we're not saying that there should be no support in schools for the children or the adults, right? But when we asked the adults why they needed police officers and the positive sort of things that police brought to schools, a lot of what we heard was that kids really benefited from having an adult to build relationships with, or a trusting adult. So it's sort of the same idea as the officer-friendly program.
Now, Kay, I hate to interrupt you. Please don't forget your point. I've got to take a break, and I want to pick up with your point on the other side. James, calling from D.C., we're going to talk to you as well. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Police reform in D.C., where are we? The Quiet Storm on WHUR is next. This continues on SiriusXM in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we ask, what is the status of D.C. police reform 1 year after the Police Reform Commission report was submitted to the D.C. Council? We continue with Nike Savain, Policy Counsel with the D.C. Justice Lab, and Ron Hampton, Convener with the D.C. Justice Collaborative, and former D.C. police officer. Both of my guests were part of authoring this commission report. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before the break, Nike was talking about the issue of police in schools and the work that they did compiling this commission report. Nike, please continue your point.
Thank you.
Sure.
So what I was trying to explain was that ultimately, when you ask people why they want police in schools, a lot of them respond with, you know, there were positive results from having relationships with trusting adults. But when we asked, why does it have to be a cop, right? Why does it have to be a police officer? We didn't really get that many concrete answers, because building trusting relationships with children is not limited to police officers, right? Violence interrupters can do that. Social workers can do that. Teachers can do that. So if you pour in support in schools, if you make it so that, let's say, parents have maybe financial or cash assistance to show up to their kids' schools more often, you can have that same result without it requiring somebody who has the authorization to arrest a child, to cause trauma, to potentially harm a child. You know, we've seen way too many incidents of police officers and school resource officers like putting their hands on children. I had a client, so I used to represent children directly in the foster care system here in D.C. I had a 9-year-old boy who his school called the police on him because he was being disruptive, and he ended up in handcuffs and sent to Children's Hospital for a psychiatric evaluation at 9. You know, and how do we expect a child like that to have a positive view of police as he gets older?
Before I go back to the phone lines, I do want to read a little bit more of this detailed statement from Council Member Charles Allen. As I mentioned earlier, he is the chair of the Committee on the Judiciary and Public Safety. And one of the things that he says in the beginning of the statement, which I think goes to the comprehensive heart of this and where the D.C. Council is, and I would imagine by default where the Metropolitan Police Department is, he says, a permanent version of the Comprehensive Policing and Justice Act will advance to a committee vote this year, much of which has been law on a continuing emergency and temporary basis since the summer of 2020. It goes on to say those emergency and temporary laws already include elements recommended by the PRC, like limiting consent searches, removing officer discipline from union contract negotiations, making more body-worn camera footage public, certainly a very big deal. And the permanent bill, he goes on to say, will include more elements when it advances this year, which I think goes back to the point that I was making, in addition to all of the other issues that have cropped up since this report was submitted regarding the rise in crime in the District of Columbia and the mayor pushing to provide a bigger programmatic thrust and tens of millions of dollars to hire more officers. As I said, you know, this is a complicated process. There's no magic wand, Nike.
Sure, there is. I agree there's not a magic wand, but that's why we were so intentional in recommending that there actually be more scrutiny, right? Mm-hmm. That we ask more questions, that we get more answers. We are part of this community, and we deserve the answers to the questions that we've asked. But I don't know if you've been paying attention to the stories this week and last week, but
ad nauseum. But yeah,
I'm sorry about that.
That's right. That's kind of what we do. But please go right ahead.
But if you know, in those stories, you'll see that the response from the administration is that it's ludicrous. It's ridiculous to ask for studies. It's ridiculous to have to answer the questions that we're asking when, you know, the math ain't mathin', and like we're not getting the kind of sort of substantive responses that we deserve as a community that is directly impacted by this. We, as Ron mentioned earlier, we recommended, and we weren't alone in recommending that there be an audit of the roles and responsibilities of the police, how they spend their time, right, what they're doing all the time.
That's
because
right.
And in 2017, the Office of the City Auditor, right, recommended the same thing. And because this number, you know, this recommendation of increasing the size of the police force has been made over and over and over for over, you know, for 15 plus years. And each time it's not backed by evidence as to the effectiveness of the practices of the police force, the role that, if any, that the size of the police force plays, you know, any of that. Because if you take a look, I mean, I was just looking at numbers from the 90s, we had way more police officers per capita then than we do now, and there was still rampant crime. So you know, there's a quote actually from our former police chief, Peter Newsham, from 2017 in an article I just read, that he says, anybody who knows anything about crime knows that more police doesn't equal less crime.
That's right. Nick, hey,
Hold on 1 second, Ron. I've got to get back to the phone because James calling from D.C. has been ultra patient. James, thank you for holding on. What's on your mind? James, go right ahead. James, are you there? I guess he lost patience. Let's go to Sherelle. Sherelle calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I heard when you were saying that, okay, the difference between these kids now, okay, when she said a 9-year-old, no, you shouldn't have to call a police officer on a 9-year-old elementary school kid.
Right.
Now, when you get in high school, they need police in those schools because two kids have gotten stabbed up at KIPP, D.C., and the kids knew that this was going to happen. Police wasn't there. They can't bring these two boys back because they're dead now. You also got these kids. I got a nephew, Johnson. They just transferred two other kids that they had, I'm going to call it a beef with. My nephew wanted to be involved. I told him, mind your business. They got these little streets, the deuces from here, because none of these kids go to school in their zone. They're all out of their zone. So if you on 22nd Street and you're Bray Farm, which is no longer there, these kids meet together in school and they fight. They bring guns. They bring knives. These are high school kids. These are not elementary kids. Don't go after the pre-Ks up to the 9-year-olds. Go after the older kids. You already know they got guns and knives and all of that. Police need to be there because, like I said, when these kids get shot, when they get stabbed, there's no coming back. The police need to be in these schools to stop all of this because not only that, who do you see running down the street with guns? The older kids, not the little ones.
Okay.
So, yes, leave the little kids alone. If you don't have a friendly in school, said when we were in school, that man said that he was there to do some. No. Officer Friendly was in that wreck making sure there was no fight. There was nothing. We knew those police by name. They don't do that anymore. And that's what these kids need. Teach the little ones how to respect the police officers. And then, you know, and the police officers to respect the kids too. But something has to be done because there's too many of these older kids running around with the guns. Don't know how to shoot. That's why everybody's getting shot. Anybody. Because you're shaking your hand like you're dancing with the gun. That's not how guns work.
Sherelle, thank you so much. And I don't want to get too much down into the weeds of just this one issue, although obviously this is an important and emotional one in the more expansive scope of what this report suggests. However, with that said, Ron, I would allow you to respond to what Sherelle was saying.
Oh, no. The point that she was making is an excellent point. These issues start in the community. And it also makes our point that some of the efforts and investment need to be put in the community. Those are the kind of things that need to be addressed in the community. We need to utilize the mayor's budget. It makes an additional investment in credible messengers and violence interrupters working in the community with the folk and working with our young people. And that's a good thing. But if the work is put in the community to quell the beast that the young people are having, that's fantastic. But we generally, again, the evidence was presented, people talked to us, there was students testifying, parents testified, and at the end of the day, it prompted the recommendations that we brought forth. And it talked about what was happening in the schools and whatnot. And that's where it is.
Okay.
But I don't think that they're going to pull them out right away. That's not what they're talking about. But they're talking about a gradual reduction of them working in the schools and creating an environment and bringing in social workers and other things. The issue about the neighborhoods and schools, that's the issue that our community and every community need to talk with DCPS about. When I was in school, we had neighborhood integrity. If you lived uptown, you went to school uptown. That prevented all of that, and we need to get back to that.
But yeah, that I that, and you know, respectfully, that may be a pipe dream because, as I said, not only are the students built differently, the parents are built differently. And that kind of integrity that you spoke about, you didn't go to school because you made the decision where you went to school. You went to school because your parents told you where you were going. By, you know,
no.
So I mean,
no, wait a minute. No, see, I'm way older than you. When I went to school, I lived in Southeast.
But my point
that
is
that was the school that people went to school.
That's my point. That's the school you went to.
Right, did.
Yeah, that's the school you went to, but you didn't decide not to go there. You went there because when you got up in the morning, your mama or your daddy or whoever you were raised by said, This is what the school system says, and that's where you go, and you didn't question it. But now,
well, you
know,
absolutely right.
Right, but what I'm saying is now.
You can have that now, though, right? You
well,
can
but
have neighborhood
but,
integrity now.
Yeah, well, I would disagree because you do have, as we have seen, over the years, that you know that parents don't like the school where their children go. They try to figure out a way to get them to another school, legally or illegally. But that's a whole different issue.
Yeah, that is. That
but
is
anyway, I got it. Sherelle, thank you so much. Let me go to Emmanuel calling from Rockville. Thank you for hanging on. What's on your mind?
Yes. I mean, policing in the school is I mean, I don't disagree with to some extent, but it's still more police need to be in the community. Because if you take, and I lived in different areas of the District of Columbia. I lived in Uptown where Wisconsin Avenue, Tinley Center, and all up through that area, where you would see police everywhere up there, around schools, around restaurants, around 7-Elevens, everywhere. Because they police the community. You can't find that in areas over in Southeast and Northeast off of Benny Road or anything like that. You don't find the police policing the community as much. Not until an incident come up, and then everybody comes out. So I believe that policing it really starts in the community too, as well as trying to put them in school. That's what my take is, because I used to work right above Connecticut Avenue. I would see police, I mean, just about everywhere on Connecticut Avenue. Everywhere. And it was a protected area. Nowadays, anything can happen in Southeast and Northeast easily. Yeah. Because they don't ride around like that. They don't come through the communities like that.
Well, Emmanuel, thank you so much for your phone call. I do want to move on to some of the broader issues, Nike. Where do you believe in the year the department has been able to make some changes, if any? I mean, if you don't believe they have, please say so. But have you seen any movement at all, even incrementally?
Unfortunately, I haven't. I haven't seen anything substantive, right? I've heard promises. Mm-hmm. I've heard the words that MPD is going to be committed to transparency and oversight of its force and treating the community with respect, but I haven't seen it in practice. For example, one of the bills that's pending that came out of a recommendation from the Police Reform Commission was a public database of police disciplinary records, right? So that we can know if there are police officers who are currently policing our streets who have numerous complaints against them, right, for use of force, excessive use of force or other sorts of misconduct. And both the police union and Chief Conte came out adamantly opposed to that, right? We've seen MPD repeatedly flout the law by not producing records that they are statutorily, so by law, required to produce every single year. Part of that is misconduct or disciplinary records. So, for example, every January, they're supposed to publish disciplinary records of their officers from the previous year. It's anonymous, so there are no names attached, but that doesn't happen. It didn't happen for so many years before the PRC was created that we weren't able to look at that information when making recommendations. Chief Conte did publish them last year in 2021, 5 years worth of data, but 2021 data hasn't been released. And they only publish that kind of data after they get called out or something like that, right? And even when data or information is made publicly available, the only information that's easy to understand for those of us who might not, you know, have all day to try to make sense of this information is information and data that is helpful to MPD's narrative, right? So if you're looking for information that might not show MPD in the best light, you have to be ready to invest a lot of time and energy into making sense of that information.
Mm-hmm. Ron, a couple of questions for you. As you probably heard, the vice chair of the D.C. Police Union has been accused of sexual misconduct. Mm-hmm. It is just an accusation. He is obviously still on the force, you know, just taking that as kind of a leaping point. Do you believe, or was there a discussion about when officers are accused of various and sundry levels of misconduct on the job, whether it be something that, you know, ends up in the death of a citizen or something like this? Do you believe that there needs to be some kind of change in how allegations against active duty officers are handled?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this information that came to us by virtue of the media, the other example was it could be online, and it would say basically the same thing. As a matter of fact, it makes our argument legitimate. They could put it online, and it would say the same thing that people in the media have been saying about. He's accused of a sexual-related crime. He's been relieved of his police power, and he's on duty somewhere. And that's all it is. You don't even have to put his name, because it hasn't been proven that he did it.
Yeah, and it's an allegation.
Yeah, it's an allegation. And there are police departments right now in New York City. They did exactly what we're talking about right now. They put all of that information on that. Police officers are public employees.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't object to my police record being online. Mm. But those who have committed crimes and acts against people in our community, we need to know in the community who those individuals are. And if they can't stand the pressure, then they need to leave and go somewhere else.
Mm. Nakay, so
I don't have an issue with that.
You want to say something, Nakay?
Yes, just briefly. I think that we need to ask ourselves why we keep treating police officers differently than anybody else who would be accused of a crime or other sort of misconduct, right? So if I were accused of some sort of crime, my picture, my name, everything would be public. You could search the D.C. court system, and you would find what I was accused of, when I was arraigned. All of that information is public, right? And I don't have the authority of the state to use force against people or to deprive them of their liberty. I think it is more important that we have public records of what our officers are doing, you know, on the streets in our name than it is to know what our, you know, the people that we might cross, the other civilians that we might cross on the street are. I think we give so much deference to police officers just because they wear a badge.
Mm. But yeah, that's right.
Thank you, Ron. Like, I think that we really need to ask ourselves why we do that, because they can cause and do cause as much, if not more, harm than other people who don't have the authority of the state behind them, and know that for us as civilians, we face way more consequences than they do. We've seen time after time after time when police officers get to hide behind their badge and do whatever it is they want, whenever they want, because they know there won't be consequences for them.
Exactly.
Ron, another question for you, mm-hmm. but Nike, I'd also like for you to share your thoughts about it. Mm-hmm. It was announced today in Minneapolis that no charges would be filed against the police officer who shot and killed Amir Locke as a result of a no-knock warrant. Ironically, no-knock warrants will no longer be used in Minneapolis starting on Friday, but still this young man is dead, as we know. He was not on the warrant. He was not a consideration by police. He was visiting friends. He had a handgun that was legally his. So now the policy after Friday, among other things, is that officers, when they are issuing or executing, I should say, a warrant, they announce themselves, then they wait 20 seconds before they enter. Your thoughts about that, Ron? Is that reform? Good idea? You've been out there. You know how that works.
No. Serving no-knock warrants, we already know it's dangerous to the public. It's dangerous to the police. So having said that, they need to be banned. And someone needs to, someone has to accept the responsibility for this young man losing his life, because everything he did was the right thing, because he didn't know who was coming in. He legally owned the handgun to protect his property. He went for his handgun, and they shot him. Now, if they had to handle that differently, then he would still be here, and they wouldn't be faced with the situation. It's proof that, and it's evidence that the serving no-knock warrants and that process is dangerous, and it's dangerous for the public as well as the police. And to somehow know to allow the police officers who committed the infraction to get away with his death as well as the violation of his rights. It's totally unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And that's why the people in our community, that's why the citizens and people in our community are pushing back on all of this stuff that's going on, because tell me where the fairness in that is. Tell mm-hmm. me where the accountability in that issue is.
Yeah. Nike, your thoughts about this Amir Locke, the results of no charges and the no-knock warrant in Minneapolis?
Yes. I mean, above all, what happened to Amir Locke is a tragedy, similar to what happened to Breonna Taylor mm-hmm. and other Black Americans and Black people generally just living in the United States, not doing anything wrong, right? Like, even Philando Castile, like, had a registered weapon on him. Right, not doing anything wrong, killed. And I think it's not just about adding 20 seconds, right? Because
no, it's not.
Even if it's 2 a.m. and you're coming at my door, you can wait 10 minutes and I might not wake up, right? Even if you're knocking. It depends how deep of sleep where I am. There's so many variables at play here. And ultimately, I think what these speak to, these sort of tinkering around the edges reforms, it's performative. It makes it look like you are making changes when you're really not. That 20 seconds is pointless, because the same result is likely whether you have those 20 seconds or not. Ultimately, what we need is respect and valuing Black lives, because Black people are always on the receiving end of harm. They are always disproportionately at the receiving end of harm by the state. And in D.C., we know that Black people make up almost the entire criminal legal system, both adult and juvenile. Mm-hmm. And none of these tiny sort of tinkering around the edges changes are going to make a real impact. That's why in our report, we recommend a holistic approach where we actually pour into the community and show that we value people in our community, that we value our neighbors, and we invest in them. Because when people... What our neighbors need are lifelines, and instead we are throwing out more and more handcuffs, and we can't keep doing that and expecting people to survive, much less thrive.
Now, Kate, from the position of an outsider looking at the totality of this report, and tell me if I'm off base here, it is comprehensive. It is a very, very deep dive. And when I say deep dive, I'm talking about my ears pop. when you after you get to, you know, deeper than 30 feet, your ears start popping. But does this appear to be a throw the whole department away and start over report? Is that overstating it, Nike?
You trying to get me in trouble?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got 4 minutes, and if you haven't gotten in trouble by now, it's not going to happen.
You need to tell the truth, because the investment in that report was intentional, Harold. Mm-hmm. It was. It wasn't designed in a way for them to pick and choose. It was designed mm-hmm. in a way for the total adoption of it, because it's not throwing it away, but it needs to be changed. And you don't mess around with change. When you get the opportunity to change something, you change it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ron. So I think, I appreciate what you're saying, Mr. Fisher, about it being a deep dive. It's funny that you mentioned that, though, because I actually think it's fairly shallow.
Really?
Right? Like, the depth of the sort of injustice of this system... we had to really think about what is feasible, right? I mean, one of your first questions was, is this too much work for our D.C. government, right? And mm-hmm. so we thought about that. And in terms of what we were recommending, we thought about what was feasible. We thought about, you know, the fact that not everybody in our community agrees yet. We're not at a place where everybody agrees on everything. So we didn't go as far as I personally would have liked to have gone. Right. The report certainly does not say just throw the whole thing away. Mm-hmm. That's not what it says.
Right.
But what it does say is that we really need to be honest with ourselves. We need to be honest about the fact that when we call the police, what we are asking for is the threat of, if not the use of, violence in our names. Right.
That's right.
on our behalf. That is what we are asking for when we call the police. And so the report is about not making police the go-to response for everything, every Amen. Single thing that, you know, displeases us, that makes us uncomfortable, or even potentially unsafe, right? We're saying invest in the community so that we have the resources to meet those needs, so that we are not constantly in a state of emergency, or that we feel like this is the only option. A lot of times when we spoke to members, you know, other members of the community, because we also are from this community and we
right.
also live here, it was just about having someone to call. That person does not have to be somebody with a gun and a badge. If it's, you know, a noise complaint about your neighbor's party, or if it's, you know, a car parked on your street that maybe is collecting tickets, or whatever, you know, other sort of non-urgent responses. Because often what happens, more often than not, right, by the time we call police, the harm has already happened or already right. begun. And so police are responsive. They're not really preventative. And what we're saying is we care so deeply about our community that we want to prevent harm as much and as often as possible. And police don't do that. So we really need to be honest about what can we do? How can we invest in our community such that we are preventing harm rather than trying to respond to harm with more harm?
Nike Sylvain and Ron Hampton, thank you both for sharing with us. I appreciate your passion, your caring, and your input. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you, Harold.
Yeah. That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, April 6th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.